Good afternoon and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. My name is James Henderson and I'm the Director of the Gas Programme here at OIES, and I'm joined today by two of my colleagues, Bassam Fatou, who's the Director of the Institute and who runs the Oil and Middle East Programme, and also by Vitaly Yermakov, who's a Senior Research Fellow and is based in Moscow. We're here to discuss global oil markets in the wake of the OPEC Plus meeting and also after the impacts, the ongoing impact of the COVID-19 epidemic. My two colleagues have both written on this subject recently. And Bassam, I'm going to turn to you first, if I may, and ask, in your recent paper, you and your co-author raised the question, indeed the title of the paper was How Oil Markets Are Coping. With oil storage filling up, it looks like not very well. But what do you think?
Thank you, Jim, for having me. It's really a great pleasure to be sharing this podcast with Vitaly. In one sense, yes, the market is coping as oil prices and differentials are doing what they are supposed to do, adjusting to send the correct signals to producers, refineries, traders, and storage holders. But at the same time, given the massive oversupply hitting the market, the physical infrastructure is being tested to its limits. This oversupply that we are seeing is the result of two severe shocks. On the demand side, we have witnessed massive year-on-year contractions in global oil demand, which according to some estimates have reached between 25 million barrels per day to 30 million barrels per day in April and May. Although it's very, very important to emphasize that these estimates are all guesswork, as there are no statistical models that can capture the relationship between GDP and oil demand, and therefore the confidence bound around these numbers are very wide. On the supply side, the break of the OPEC Plus meeting resulted in key OPEC producers increasing their production in March and April. The effects of the cut from the agreement reached on Easter will start showing, but only from May. This supply-demand imbalance has been reflected in the benchmark futures prices, such as Brent and WTI, which did fall sharply, with Brent currently trading at below $30 per barrel. Back in January, Brent traded above $70 per barrel. But in the paper you refer to, Jim, we argued that the recent movements in the futures prices and their volatility capture only part of the picture and do not fully reveal the extent of the large imbalances building in the system. In order to capture these imbalances, it's important to look at some key physical differentials and spread. We argue in the paper that in the extreme market conditions that we are currently witnessing, it is the differentials which do most of the adjustment to reflect the underlying changes in the physical market and the shift in trade flows. And we currently believe that the disconnect between the futures prices and the physical differentials, which is pointing towards a much more distressed market. Just to give you an example, Jim, the Dated Brent, which is the closest you can get to the spot market, was trading at one point around $10 below the forward futures. Also, as producers compete to place their barrels, they're offering their crudes at a huge discount. So the price at which barrels are being physically exchanged are much lower than futures prices, with some good quality crudes trading closer to $10 per barrel. So the markets are doing their job, but with the physical differentials doing most of the adjustment and pointing towards a much weaker market. And it's a matter of time before the futures price will fall towards the physical prices. But also, to give the incentive for players to store the excess crude, the market has shifted from backwardation to a super contango. As the excess supply persisted, we started running out of cheaper storage facilities to more expensive ones, such as floating storage. Basically, what we're doing now, storing oil in ships. So the contango had to deepen to reflect the increasing cost of storage. The contango players will buy the crude, store it, and sell it forward through the futures contract, which will put pressure on the back end of the curve with the entire futures curve shifting downward. At one point, if this imbalance continues, the oil has to be stored underground, and oil prices have to go lower to make this happen. OPEC has historically played this role, restricting their supplies and keeping their oil underground, despite them being the lowest cost producer. And they do that in order to support prices and increase revenues. I believe that in the current context, the new OPEC Plus agreement will contribute to the rebalancing, but it may not be enough, and some of the adjustment has to fall on the higher cost and less financially viable producer, which they need to shut in production and keep their oil in underground. So in conclusion, both the OPEC plus mechanism of restricting output and the shut-in mechanism need to combine this time to balance the market, with OPEC plus perhaps playing a bigger role.
Thanks for that. You touched on the fundamentals of supply and demand already, and I'd like to just dig into that in a bit more detail if I may. I'll come to supply in a moment, but the current crisis is really a demand shock, isn't it? I mean, the collapse in demand in relation to the COVID-19 epidemic and the lockdowns in many countries has been nothing short of dramatic. Could you just give us a bit of detail about that?
Absolutely. This is first and foremost a demand shock. And while supply dynamics attracted a lot of the media attention, to me, the price war was somehow a sideshow in terms of market balances and prices. Our analysis at the Institute shows that even if there has been no change in the supply picture and producers did not increase production, Brent would have fallen below $30 in any case. What the breakup of the OPEC Plus did, it pushed prices lower and faster. But overall, the contribution of supply to the price decline remains relatively small compared to the demand factors. So yes, I agree with you, Jim.
So Vitaly, let me come to you now and say, let's talk on about the supply side. I mean, you're sitting there in Moscow, and we've just published a paper on Russia's short-term and long-term thinking around the oil market. How did you view Russia's initial strategy going into that March the 6th OPEC Plus meeting in Vienna?
Thanks, Jim. Well, first, I think it would be interesting to look briefly back at 2016, when we also had a major oil crisis. Maybe not as severe as now, but still, it was a big crisis, and prices were almost as low as they are now. It was during that time when it became obvious for everyone that the effective trench warfare and the volume war started to inflict tremendous damage for everyone involved, that the Saudis started talking to the Russians about possible cooperation. And this eventually led to the OPEC Plus format. Markets were very skeptical at first, referring to the canonical prisoner's dilemma paradox. They saw that initiative on the part of OPEC and other major producers would not work due to suspicions and absence of meaningful mechanism to ensure compliance. But to everyone's surprise, the deal worked. It helped rebalance the market then, and for almost 3 years, it brought benefits to both sides. However, by the beginning of 2020, the situation started to change. We started seeing the new glut building in the market, and I guess this is when this strange alliance, I recall Shakespeare once said that misery creates strange bedfellows, but OPEC plus where Saudis and the Russians were just working together, was a little bit this strange arrangement. It started to create tensions. And by the beginning of March, around the time of this OPEC Plus meeting, which failed, Russia's position changed somewhat. We're lucky to have an account of Russia's strategy from one of the key persons involved in the negotiations, Russia's Deputy Energy Minister Pavel Sorokin, who has been a rising star within Russia's energy ministry, and he's been involved in all negotiations with the Saudis. He gave a big interview to two Reuters correspondents in Russia a few days after the deal in March 6 failed. We reviewed this long interview in our paper, and it gives a very honest, detailed, complete account of Russia's strategy. But I will just quote Sorokin on the key point, which I believe is really key to understanding why Russia walked away from the deal in the early March. He said, quote, "We cannot fight a falling demand situation when there is no clarity about where the bottom of demand is. It is very easy to get caught in a circle when by cutting once, you get into an even worse situation in, say, 2 weeks. All prices will shortly bounce back before falling again as demand continued to fall." So in conclusion, I think this quote stresses Russia's concern about this ambiguity over the situation with demand as coronavirus started to spread.
Okay, thanks. I'll come back to you for a bit more on the Russian position in a second. But Bassam, perhaps I could turn back to you now and just get your view on the Saudi position around that March 6th meeting and its aftermath. There have been some who have taken the view that Saudi Arabia had planned all along to increase production and crash prices to get rid of higher cost producers, in particular US shale. Do you think that's right?
Hi, Jim. Yes, there have been a lot of conspiracy theories circulating. Some of the analysis that I have come across suggests that Saudi Arabia had always the intention to shift to high volume, low price strategy, and it has been preparing for such a shift for some time. And some go as far as arguing that the break of the OPEC Plus presented the perfect opportunity to shift policy while blaming it on the Russians. And to support this argument, some have pointed out to different pieces of evidence. For instance, some argue that the recent settlement of an old dispute between Riyadh and Kuwait, which allowed the restart of shale oil field, was no coincidence and undermined the view that Saudi's decision was a spur of the moment escalation after Russia said no to production cuts. I personally think this view suffers from major shortcomings. To begin with, the fact that one event happened before the other does not imply causality. The negotiations between Saudi Arabia and Kuwait to restart production from the neutral zone have been going on for many years, with parties signing the agreement only when the key issues have been resolved. Second, I would say Saudi Arabia really does not need an excuse to shift its oil policy. If this is indeed a new permanent policy, they would have announced it publicly. And even if they did, it cannot really be hidden. Also, all the Saudi signals and actions before and during the OPEC March meeting indicate that the kingdom tried to reach an agreement on output cuts. And this view of shifting permanently is also at odds with the recent producers' agreement, which Saudi Arabia has led and which has agreed to cut its output drastically. And even if we assume that Saudi Arabia did shift its oil strategy towards market share, the timing of implementation matters. You know, for instance, Saudi Arabia could have implemented this new strategy at times when demand is not contracting sharply and perhaps would have implemented it in a more gradual phase. Also, a permanent shift in policy requires transforming the entire ecosystem, including, for instance, Saudi relations with other producers, its position within OPEC, and there are no indications that such transformations have occurred. Finally, I would argue that in any negotiation, especially when indications are that reaching an agreement is not feasible, parties need to prepare for alternative scenarios and potential responses. The fact that Saudi Arabia can increase its production at a short notice, and it has the infrastructure to support such increases, gives it much more option than other producers and more power to influence the direction of the market and other players' behavior. So just to conclude, I think this issue of the shift in policy is not important only from a historical perspective, but it's key to understanding the future shape and the pace of the recovery. It makes a huge difference whether one thinks Saudi Arabia has permanently abandoned its previous role or whether this was a tactical move shaped by the current events.
Okay, thanks. That's very interesting. Vitaly, I want to turn to you now and talk about the motivations for Russia. I mean, you've mentioned Pavel Sorokin's main statement about not fighting a battle where you don't know the battle lines are drawn, if you like. But there's been a lot of talk amongst leading Russian oil players around the fact that US shale has been the main beneficiary of the OPEC Plus agreement since 2016. And there have been some who've suggested that the destruction of US shale was one of the motivations for Russia, if you like, playing hardball on March the 6th. Do you think that's right? Do you think that was a main motivation?
Jim, it is true that since the time OPEC Plus agreement started to be effective, the U.S. managed to increase their oil output by 4 million barrels per day, I believe. So it was the largest incremental increase since 2017. So in this sense, I believe it was somewhat of a free ride. But I don't think that if we single out the U.S. title producers, we are going to get the correct picture. And here again, I find Sorokin's interview extremely frank about Russia's motivations. He said that some market players mistakenly decided that OPEC Plus would target a certain price range and cut output to protect its low bracket. And based on this assumption, this player started to increase investments. And these investments included, well, some projects, obviously, with Thai Oil in the United States, but also Canadian tar sands, offshore projects in Brazil, Gulf of Mexico. So there was a whole wave of new projects which were probably reckless to implement on such a scale, because most of these projects were very high cost. And in this sense, the free ride of this new entrance was making each consecutive production by OPEC Plus less and less efficient. And so it also meant, obviously, that at some point OPEC Plus would have to expand its supply to protect the market from a new wave of uneconomic projects. And to conclude, I think that this larger concern over the new glut, this obviously affected both Saudi Arabia and Russia in how they approached the issue of production cuts.
Okay, thanks for that. That's very interesting. I mean, just moving on in sort of time, if you like, obviously we've seen that collapse of the OPEC Plus agreement back on March the 6th, but we've now very rapidly got a new agreement, and many people are giving Donald Trump much of the credit making that happen. What do you think really catalyzed action last weekend, and how important is the US position? I mean, I've just noticed in the FT this morning, the US Energy Secretary is saying that oil politics had changed forever. Bassam, I'll turn to you first. How was the recent meeting viewed from a Saudi perspective, and are we seeing now a fundamental shift in Saudi and indeed OPEC policy?
Jim, I don't think we are seeing a fundamental shift in Saudi policy over this cycle. Since 1986, Saudi Arabia has always adhered to one key principle, and they've never moved away from this principle. The kingdom is in favor of market management, but any cut should be collective, with other producers participating in sharing the burden of adjustment, especially big producers such as Russia. And this is happening against a background where the kingdom is showing lower tolerance to cheating. It's true that the Saudi economy is still highly reliant on oil revenue, but this has not prevented it from pursuing market share strategy from time to time, resulting in oil price collapsing. And geopolitically, the kingdom values highly its alliance with the US, and it's highly sensitive to the interests and the actions of its key ally. I don't think this is new. I think what is new is the US duality, that in a low price environment, it acts as a producer and it prefers a higher oil price. And in a high price environment, the US acts as a consumer and wants a lower oil price. So how does the recent behavior really, you know, measure against these? So let me just, you know, a couple of points. You know, as I mentioned before, it's not the first time that Saudi Arabia pursues market share strategy. And when they do it with the intention to have maximum impact on players and prices. In the absence of enforcement mechanism to ensure discipline and compliance among producers, this is bound to happen. Of course, price wars hurt all producers, and it's difficult not to be blamed for its consequences. But at the same time, history shows that when faced with a bad deal, or what Saudi Arabia considers as a bad deal, or when it has to bear the burden of the adjustment, Saudi Arabia is willing to pursue a high-volume, low-price strategy. Back in March, I think this is exactly what happened. They thought that the Russia's offer of an extension was a bad deal, and ineffective, and made really little difference to the prices. In fact, at the Institute, we have calculated that the revenues payoff between a bad deal and market share strategy are not that different in the short term, as oil prices would have fallen anyway. But at the same time, we also know that Saudi Arabia does reverse its policy when market conditions and players' behavior change. And OPEC Plus producers did agree on a substantial cut, which Saudi Arabia always wanted, but it was not feasible back in March. And, you know, as you discuss in your paper, because the Russians at that point were not willing to cut deeper. But I think what is quite important is that the agreement reinforced the principles of a collective cuts, with even new producers joining and having the support of the G20 and the US. So in conclusion, I think all these are consistent with the historical behavior of the kingdom. And the differences are in a couple of areas, I think. Trump's intervention did put pressure on all producers to accelerate the process of reaching an agreement. Without the US, an agreement would have been reached, but it would have taken longer. And I believe that there is a new oil order emerging, where the interactions between Saudi Arabia, US, and Russia will really be the key to shaping future oil market outcomes. I think the current events will only reinforce this. And I think Vitaly perhaps agrees with me on that.
Yeah, well, let's turn to Vitaly then. Vitaly, what do you think changed Russian minds? I mean, it was an extraordinary and complete reversal in tactics in agreeing to come to the table with such a huge cut. What do you think caused the change of heart? I mean, is Russia really going to cut its crude oil output by as much as promised? And in your paper, you mentioned, you know, the role of gas condensate in calculating Russia's production quote. Can you say a bit more about that and whether that potentially is going to mask some of the cut?
Oh, well, so many questions. Well, first of all, let me agree with Bassam on this point that the new deal would have to involve larger number of players and greater level of cooperation. Speaking of Russia, obviously, and why Russia changed its approach, obviously the realization of the scale of the demand destruction has played a major role. We now know much more about how deeply the crisis has affected the global economy. I mean, in the beginning of March, everyone, including the sort of top international organizations, we were not predicting a major decline in oil demand. Now everyone is talking about huge demand destruction. And so also the risk that the oil market could run out of storage in a month and a half became a clear and present danger. It still is. And this is like a ticking bomb for the oil market. And the new deal attempts to buy some time in the hope that the world will be reopening for business by the end of the summer. So in this situation, the volume war became totally inappropriate. And the oil industry was seen in a bad light by sort of creating all this additional calamity in already struggling marketplace. Now, the actions, I think, should be guided by the same principle the doctors use when they treat the patients. First of all, do no harm. And in the end, the industry, I think, followed this basic principle. They acted on this premise. Let's do no harm. Let's agree on the cuts. And Russia essentially did the right thing with other players. Turning to Russia's commitment to specific output cuts, the agreed level to which Russia should bring down its crude oil production during May-June is 8.5 million barrels per day. After that, Russia, along with other participants of the new deal, will start gradually relaxing the restrictions. It's important to note that the deal was supposed to last almost 2 years, and so some restrictions are going to remain in place for quite some time. Another important point is that in the new agreement, the baseline oil production for both Russia and Saudi Arabia, from which the cuts must be implemented, was set at 11 million barrels per day. But it's important to understand that this 11 million barrels per day is just an agreed level, a compromise figure. It is not the measure of actual oil production for Russia in any given months of 2020. Russia's crude oil output in the first quarter of 2020 was about 10.3 million barrels per day. So the real production cut for Russia is going to be around 1.8 million barrels per day, not often cited number of 2.5. And this is where gas condensate issue comes into play. Usually, Russian statistical reporting contains the number that reports oil and gas condensate together. And so they often cited Russia's oil output of 11.3 million barrels per day in 2019 includes gas condensate. But the quotas for each OPEC member are calculated on the basis of crude oil only. These quotas exclude NGLs, including condensate. But Russia originally, when it just joined OPEC Plus, Russia's output was measured and quotas were calculated on the basis of sort of this statistical agreement that Russia used internally, that all the numbers were calculated in relation to oil and condensate together. Only in December of 2019, Russia argued successfully that the methodology of the quota calculation should be uniform for both OPEC and non-OPEC members of the agreement. And this allowed Russia to exclude gas condensate from its overall production number starting in December. And definitely this applies to the present agreement. So that's again, the advertisement of 2.5 million barrels per day cuts should be measured against this technical reality of somewhat smaller cuts. Having said that, and maybe to conclude answering this part of the questions, it is still, it's a tremendous cut for Russia.
Yeah, no, it certainly is. And I guess we shouldn't get too hung up about small statistical numbers when we're talking about such a massive collapse in demand. But which kind of brings me to my next question for you, Bassam. You know, so we've now got this new OPEC Plus agreement to cut 9.7 million barrels a day. But is it really going to make any difference? I mean, or will it need others such as G20 to play a role both on the supply side and on the demand side if we're going to get anywhere near the kind of 20 million barrel a day impact that Trump and others have been talking about? How do you see that playing out?
Jim, without doubt, yes, it will have an impact, and I think an important impact. One important aspect of the deal to me is that it sends the correct signals that producers are cooperating again, because the alternative would have been, you know, price wars and, suppliers not getting together and all of that. And that would have sent a very bearish sentiment to the market. In terms of the physical balances, the impact will not be felt immediately given the scale of the demand shock. But I think what the deal does, it reinforces the pace of recovery when demand eventually recovers. So without the OPEC cuts, we would have continued to build stocks into the third quarter and the fourth quarter, and putting strains on the storage facilities. In fact, our preliminary analysis showed that current cuts and some sort of a V-shaped recovery in demand can combine to balance the market in 2021 and turning the surplus into deficit. This also includes the losses that we're going to see from outside the OPEC Plus, as I mentioned before, as low oil prices hit and there's going to be a lot of shut-in production. But as discussed before, the uncertainty around demand makes such an exercise futile in a way. And there are three issues in my mind. The first one is, have we seen the worst of the contraction? The second one is, once demand recovers, will we go back to the pre-virus levels of consumption? And third, even if we do, are we likely to see growth rate continue at the pre-virus levels? We have to wait and see, but my guess is that we will not necessarily get back to the pre-virus level, at least not in 2021, but growth rate will continue at levels similar to historical rates once things stabilize. But it's also important to stress that while some demand might be destroyed, we also may witness supply destruction. In other words, we may end up with a balanced market in 2021, but overall, the market is much smaller. So as I mentioned before, just to conclude, is that, you know, the combination of the OPEC cuts plus what the market's going to do in terms of shut-ins, I think we're going to see those. But it really all depends on demand. And given the uncertainty about demand, it's very, very difficult to see, you know, how the market will work out.
Okay, thanks. I mean, I think obviously compliance with the cuts is therefore going to be important. And Vitaly, can I just have a brief comment from you on compliance? As you mentioned, the proposed production cuts from Russia are enormous. Historically, there have always been concerns expressed on the Russian side about the operational limitations on implementing cuts. Do you see there being any limitations this time on implementing cuts, or do you think they can actually get 2 million barrels a day there or thereabouts off production relatively rapidly?
Well, we are in uncharted waters because the scale and the abruptness of the cuts are unprecedented. Well, it's true that Russia experienced very large declines in output in the 1990s. But then it happened naturally over the relatively long period of time as a result of sharply reduced investment, of the lack of investment. But now it has to be done in the course of 2-3 weeks. And the problem, well, Well, let me say that the problem is not about cutting production. The problem, the real problem, is about bringing it back in the future. And so the real challenge is how to reduce output in such a way that would not result in permanent damage to the wells. Speaking of possible damage, obviously reducing output in May when it's getting warmer, it would be technically easier for Russia to do than, say, in March. So the time that Russia has won by negotiating, I think it creates an easier situation from the technical point of view in implementing the cuts. Well, the key questions are going to be which assets to pick up for this reduced output. It's inevitable that large producing fields would have to be involved. Russia has many wells and entire fields in Western Siberia and the Volga Urals with extremely high water cuts, because water flooding is one of the key techniques of increasing reservoir pressure and increasing oil output. But the fields and wells with extremely high water cuts, maybe just over 90%, some of them 95%, they have marginal economics, would be natural candidates for closure. And there are different estimates of what percentage of Russia's total output these marginal wells represent, around 7% probably, maybe even higher than that. But if these are to be shut in, they would probably never come back. And in effect, there's going to be a real trade-off for Russian oil companies, whether they reduce output at some of the newer fields, which would be easier to bring back, or they would cut those marginal wells, which probably would never start producing again. But that's a real trade-off, and I don't think that anyone has a good answer at this point. There's also another trade-off. How the quotas are going to be distributed among Russian producers, whether this is going to be done on a prorated basis relative to their output, or some companies would get lower quotas. Obviously, small independents are going to be excluded. The big issue is about Rosneft. It accounts for 38% of Russia's total oil output, so it has to be a major contributor in any cuts. But on the other hand, Rosneft has received significant prepayments for a large share of its output from the Chinese as part of the so-called ESPO deal. Rosneft has been supplying lots of oil to the Chinese via this East Siberia Pacific Ocean pipeline. And that's a key uncertainty how the government is going to decide on this issue. Then another trade-off is what is going to happen to decision-making about the production cuts because of the existing tax breaks for many fields. Some of the fields receive tax breaks specifically because they have marginal economics. But now that those tax breaks are in place, these fields probably... the companies probably would exclude those fields from production cuts. So again, it's somehow it's going to change the incentives and distort the incentives relative to the first best solutions. Yeah. So to conclude, the bottom line, the trade-offs are real and they're difficult.
Okay, and yeah, clearly, I mean, a lot for the Russian oil companies to think about then as they implement cuts pretty rapidly. I mean, we're coming to the end of our time now, so I'm gonna sort of wrap up now by asking both of you kind of slightly longer dated questions, if you like. But Sam, what do you think's next for Saudi Arabia? I mean, the FT today, the price war was described as an unwelcome departure from its strategy. Do you think it will now revert to its old cooperation strategy, or are we? We're at a point where we're going to see a complete switch and indeed a greater involvement of non-OPEC producers for the longer term. How do you think the Saudis view the longer term now?
Jim, as I mentioned before, the break in the producers' policy towards high volume, low price, was really not the strategy in a sense. But as we mentioned before, that Saudi Arabia does from time to time actually move to market share strategy if it feels that the burden of the cut is falling on just on its shoulders. Spencer Dale, the chief economist from BP, and I have argued before in a paper that there are serious constraints in pursuing a high-volume no-oil price policy, given oil exporters' lack of income diversification and their high reliance of oil revenue. Such a policy could result in a prolonged period of very low oil prices, which producers cannot sustain. Some producers can sustain more than others, and perhaps Saudi Arabia can sustain it more than others, but at the end of the day, everyone feels their pain. But what I would like to add that the approach of managing the market has become more costly. As the size of the cuts needed to balance the market are getting bigger, and as producers need to implement them for longer, those type of agreements have become increasingly difficult to reach and more costly to maintain. I think the Mexico standoff during the latest OPEC Plus meeting shows that actually no producer's interest can be ignored. And it's becoming clear that there is now a need to think of a new format for more effective coordination among producers. So, in short, there is no doubt that the current policy of market management has its challenges, but one also needs to realize that the alternative strategy of pursuing market share also has its challenges.
Okay, thanks. And Vitaly, last and please, brief word to you. You know, Russia has now sees itself and has for a while seen itself as one of the big three players. And indeed, because of its low-cost production, its, you know, its flexible exchange rate and its large reserves, as we described in our paper, it sees itself in a pretty strong position. How do you see it perceiving itself and its place in the global oil market going forward?
Well, thanks, Jim. I mean, the long answer is in our paper, and I would welcome, would urge everyone to read it. And the short answer is, well, Russia is going to remain one of the big three, big producers, along with the US and the Saudis. Russia's key advantages in this test of resolve, because the next few years are going to be difficult, irrespective of this recent deal. Key advantages that Russia enjoys are its stable fiscal position, flexible ruble exchange rate, which keeps dollar costs relatively low, flexible tax take, which captures the windfall during the period of high oil prices, but also protects the companies when the oil prices are low. And also a large share of brownfields with relatively low costs and the overall production in Russia for now. So these are the key strengths. Thank you.
Okay, Vitaly, Bassam, thank you very much indeed for your contributions. They've been absolutely fascinating. Thanks to you for listening. I hope you found this podcast interesting. You can find both the papers that we've been discussing, which are called The New Deal for Oil Markets, Implications for Russia's Short-Term Tactics and Long-Term Strategy, and Shocks and Differentials, How Are the Oil Markets Coping, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org, where you can find all our other research and all our podcasts as well. So with that, thank you again to our speakers. We look forward to speaking to you again soon. Thank you and goodbye.